Hello, Dominic.
Hello, Katie.
And hello, producers Katz Laszlo and Wojciech Oleksiak.
Hey.
Hello.
What are you doing here?
That's me. You can't invite us and then ask us what we're doing here.
Yeah, Katie.
What are you doing here?
What are you like? We're all together because it's a big day today. It is the first day of the European elections.
A four-day extravaganza.
I think it says a lot about these elections in comparison to like American elections. We have to like explain what we're doing here and why we're all here and like what this episode is even about. I just can't imagine that happening in a US election.
Which is crazy because there are like 373 million people eligible to vote in these elections, which is almost 150 million more voters than in the US elections. I think it's officially the second biggest elections in the world, right?
Who are the first?
India. But I was wondering, are there any other international elections in the world? I tried Googling this briefly and I couldn't find any other examples, but I don't ever hear the European Parliament elections being described as the world's only international election. So maybe there are some others.
But isn't that because it's actually 27 national elections happening over the same few days and then being amalgamated together?
That's a question that we might be discussing today.
Anyway, we invited you, Katz and Wojciech, today because we also wanted to just have a chat about whether you're noticing that the elections are happening wherever you are living in Europe. How is it over there in Warsaw, Wojciech?
Yeah, so in Warsaw, it's very about Poland and about national political struggles.
9 czerwca wybierzmy tych, którzy mówią tak dla wolności. Wybierzmy prawo i sprawiedliwość.
It's the third consecutive election within the span of 6 months. So there is this noticeable fatigue. And I have to say, I have not seen an election campaign that sleepy.
You would think that now that there's a much, much, much more pro-EU government in place in Poland, there might be a bit more excitement about it, but apparently not.
Yeah, I think there is just, you know, like a limited amount of elections you can make people excited about. Mm. Basically, Poles are pretty bad historically in voting in European election. I just checked this and I was, even though I knew it was bad, I didn't know it was that bad. The first election we voted was 2004 and we had not even 21% of the turnout.
Wow.
Then it got a bit better, slightly under 25, but then 2014, 24%. And then out of the blue, 2019, 45%. But you just have to know that all these elections are super closely tied to what's happening in the national politics. I have not seen anybody like discussing European matters. It's just about like, you know, who did what during the reign of law and justice, how it's being fixed. It's really a mixture of like just, you know, political shit show and campaigners trying to energize people and do something about the turnout, because I think everybody is afraid of going back to the realm of 20-something percent, which is just a shame, fellow Poles. It's a shame.
I did find it amazing to look at like the difference in turnout numbers. Like in some countries it's like 12% and in other countries it's 84%. It's really astonishing how much it varies.
I think it's mandatory somewhere, right?
Belgium?
Yeah. In Belgium.
Do you guys know if it's mandatory in Luxembourg or are they just really good at voting there? Because there it was also like 84% or something.
Yes. Just seeing here online that voting in Luxembourg is mandatory.
Huh.
How are things looking over there in the Netherlands where you guys are, Dominic and Katz?
Oh, I mean, it's not possible for the European election really to compete with the chaos that is our national politics at the moment, with a coalition trying to form with the far right leading it. And yeah, so it's not really so present, is it, Katz?
No, I don't think I've been in a single conversation where it's come up and I haven't brought it up myself.
Verkiezingen. Met nog een kleine week te gaan, kunnen we opnieuw naar de stembus, dit keer voor een nieuw parlement in de EU. Maar waar stemmen we nou precies op? Ja, de meeste mensen.
But you're in Hungary recently and it was a very different state of affairs, right?
Yeah, I think that's when I realized like, oh, we're really not talking about this in the Netherlands, because I was in Hungary and on every single street there was like 25 posters with all of the different candidates, and I saw a couple of Fidesz people campaigning on the street, and I just not seen anything like that here.
And that was quite a while ago, right? This was,
yeah, I think this was like a little over a month ago. I wondered if it was because it's difficult for all the other parties to be featured in the newspapers, so maybe that's why it happens outside of newspapers, but I'm not sure because I don't speak any Hungarian except for the word Hungarian in Hungarian. Sorry, Grandpa Laszlo.
Majar.
Exactly.
How is it in Paris, Katie? Are you feeling European excitement?
Oh, well, you know, Parisians are not known for being the most enthused people on earth about anything. And I wouldn't say that the European elections are any different. Here, again, it's being viewed like very much through a national politics lens. And I would say the thing that most people are talking about is the fact that the far right Rassemblement National is predicted to do very, very well, probably getting about twice the share of the vote of Macron's crew.
Possibly becoming the biggest party in the whole parliament, right?
So that's a fun thing to look out for.
En clair, l'extrême droite qui prend du poids et des points dans les sondages. En France, la liste du Rassemblement National aussi entre 30 et 33%.
So I think I should start probably with a quick reminder before we go any further. What we're actually voting for this week is for the members of the European Parliament, or MEPs. There are 720 of them, and the number of MEPs that each country has depends on the size of your country's population.
There's actually a really good country-by-country guide on Politico. So if you want to find out quickly how many MEPs there are in your country, and crucially, what day you're voting on, because it is spread out over the next 4 days, that's a really good place to start. I'll put a link for that in the show notes.
I feel I should also point out that Europeans are not voting directly for the European Commission this week, which is the kind of executive body of the EU who propose the new laws. It's a bit confusing because the party grouping leaders are some of them people who are hoping to be the Commission president or commissioners, like Ursula von der Leyen, for example, who's the current president and wants to be chosen for a second term.
Good to be here in this room with you and to share my vision for Europe.
But the makeup of the Commission will be rejected or accepted by the new Parliament after the commissioners are all put forward by each country's democratically elected national governments. Are you still with me?
Yes, just about.
The European Parliament, the European Commission, the European Council, not to be confused with the Council of the EU, which is also known colloquially as Council of Ministers. Confused yet? Tell me about it.
Anyway, the upshot of all of this is that these elections will have a really big impact on the kinds of policies that we're going to see shaping this continent over the next half decade. But the whole thing can be kind of difficult to unpick if you live outside the Brussels bubble, as we do. So to make sense of this whole thing, we're going to dedicate the rest of this week's podcast to a conversation with one of the very few people we know who can talk about EU politics in a way that doesn't put us to sleep. And that is the Spanish journalist, Beatrice Rios.
Beatrice is a freelance EU reporter who wears many different hats on radio, TV, and in print. She's amazing, and we're so pleased she agreed to spend some time with us earlier this week to help us understand the significance of these elections and why we should go out and cast our votes.
Hi, Beatrice.
Hi.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us today. Nice to have you back on the show.
Are you actually enjoying being a correspondent in Brussels right now, or is this like an incredibly stressful time for you?
Honestly, right now it's kind of quiet because all the actions is really in the capitals. But I think after the elections, we're going to be very busy here.
Now, we're probably going to spend a lot of this conversation being a bit miserable and critical. So I was hoping we could start with something positive. And I wanted to ask you, what do you think the European Union should be proud of in terms of its achievements over the last 5 years?
Excellent question. And indeed, it's hard to answer. No. Let's just try to stay positive. Honestly, I think one of the biggest achievements was the way the pandemic was handled from a socioeconomic perspective.
The European Union just announced that it is firing off a multi-billion dollar investment initiative and says it's going to provide maximum flexibility on state aid to help member states cushion the blow from the coronavirus outbreak.
I think the EU learned the lesson from the latest economic crisis. And in this case, they put a lot of effort in trying to support people throughout the pandemic, allowing countries to put a lot of money into social funds for those who are losing their jobs. And not only through the Next Generation EU, which is this EU recovery fund, but also through a number of mechanisms to allow countries to be a little bit more flexible in the way they supported workers, especially when they were in temporary unemployment. I think that was a huge achievement. Then I'd say there are a lot of social policies that came through that are good for regular people. We have had an agreement on setting minimum standards for minimum wages. We have seen also a new legislation to regulate platform workers. So it's basically people who are working in platforms like Uber or, you know, like food delivery and so on. They're not perfect, but I think they are good concrete achievements for the regular people. Something that personally is very close to my heart is the directive on gender-based violence. I think it's very important that we have EU legislation that is applicable in all countries, because not every country treats gender-based violence in the same way. Again, even if it's not perfect, it's definitely a step forward. And honestly, even if now it's rather controversial or it's being criticized, I think everything that has been done on the Green Deal, all the very concrete policies and legislation that has been passed to reduce emission, to make more sustainable transport, to make more sustainable energy, but also the reform of the energy market that would translate into lower invoices for people, all those are very concrete achievements that are going to have a long-term impact for people in Europe.
That's a quite decent list. It's kind of nice to start off with that bit of positivity. Should we do the miserable bit now?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I wanted to ask, because you've been in Brussels for a long time now, how does this election feel different to the last one in 2019?
I think it's different because we have a more polarized society, and that is reflected in the position that the different political parties have. Those MEPs that you are electing from your country are going to sit in different political families. In 2019, we moved from a parliament that was dominated by the two main political families, so the European People's Party, which are Christian Democrats, and the Social Democrats. And in 2019, we saw a significant rise of the Liberals, a significant rise of the Greens, and then a far left that was rather stable. And an increase of the far right, but it's still relatively limited compared to the rest of the European Parliament. So we still had a large majority that was pro-European, let's say. What we see in the polls for 2024 is that the size of the far right is going to grow significantly. And some of those forces that grew in 2019, like the Liberals and the Greens, are going to shrink. As of now, we still have a prospect of a large enough majority from the center-right to the left, that would be enough to overcome the far-right. Now, depending on how much the polls are actually predicting the actual result, we're going to see if the far-right grows enough so that they can really be able to influence a lot more politics. And I think it's different because what we see is more people leaning towards voting not only far-right political parties, but parties that are against further European integration. And that is a first in history.
Brussels has become a swamp. A swamp where unelected bureaucrats are going to utilize their vision of a European federalized superstate. And we have to stop that.
So for people who don't follow Brussels politics that much, what kind of impact will the outcome of these elections have on the kind of policies that get made for Europe over the next 5 years?
So I think this is an important question because I think it gives us the chance to explain a little bit how decisions are made in Brussels. And the particularity of the European Union is that even if the elections are to the European Parliament doesn't necessarily work like a national parliament, because it's part of a co-decision process. So the decisions in the EU, especially on legislation, are made between the European Parliament and the Council. And the Council, you have the representation of the member states, so the countries of the EU, and then in Parliament, you elect directly the members, which is what we are going to do on the 9th of June, right? And I say this because sometimes there is a growing frustration among people because certain legislation passes or doesn't pass. And we need to understand that there are a lot of different players here.
It's always great to repeat it because I think like 98% of European citizens don't know what the different institutions of the EU are still.
Yeah, and that has an impact on the legislation that it's approved, right? Like, just to give an example right now, we have a situation where the Parliament has approved the Nature Restoration Law. It's a legislation that's trying to protect ecosystems that are at risk. But the Council hasn't done it yet. So it might be a case where you have two parts of the EU agreeing on legislation, but then the legislation never really gets approved because one part of the equation is not doing their part. Mm-hmm. But that's also why the European Parliament is so important. It's the one institution that all EU citizens get to elect directly. So you're going to define which politicians are going to represent your interest in the European Parliament. What is happening now is that you have far-right and conservative political parties most likely having a significant representation in the European Parliament. And that has an impact in the kind of policies that you do, because they have a very different vision from the European Union that we know. They are more inclined to less integration, to less say at European level on national policies. They have a tougher view on migration. They have a tougher view on gender-based policies. They have a tougher approach on climate change. So all that, if they have a significant majority in the European Parliament, is going to make that the legislation that we see is less progressive. And that has an impact, because in this game that I was talking about between the Council and the Parliament, usually the Parliament is the most progressive institution. To some extent, they care more about the European perspective and not so much about the national perspective. But if you have a Parliament that not only is not as progressive, but it's even more conservative than the representation of the different countries in the EU, then most likely you will see less integration and less progressive policy that are implemented from Brussels.
I mean, is it possible to say what are the main political issues in voters' minds across Europe? What are the main political issues on politicians' lips? Or is that just too difficult a question to answer, given that we're talking about 27 different countries here?
Usually people, when they vote in the European elections, they vote according to whatever it is the most important issue at national level. So in Poland, that might be security or the agricultural crisis. In Italy, that might be migration. But if we look at the main issues that people say are going to defend their vote, we see that the countries that are closest to Russia and therefore are more affected by the potential consequences of the war in Ukraine are more prone to vote on issues such as security and defense. And when we see other countries that are struggling mainly with the cost of living crisis, they're more concerned about inequalities. There might be some issues that we can find in different countries, but then every citizen is going to vote depending on what is at stake in their country.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a second. This episode is only possible thanks to the very generous support of our Patreon supporters. Thank you so much for keeping this podcast alive with your very generous donations. You can join them by heading to patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. So if we keep trying to zoom out and look at how this campaign's been going at the Europe-wide level, which I appreciate is sometimes difficult, each of the party groupings has a leader who is hoping to become president of the Commission. They're called the Spitzenkandidat. You've got Ursula von der Leyen for the centre-right, and you've got this guy, Nicolas Schmidt, for the Social Democrats.
You are the young generation. You're building your life. And what we owe you is to provide you the real security. A good job, a good environment, a good, secure Europe, fighting all those who want to destroy our democracy.
Does it matter who is leading the campaign on this EU-wide level? I mean, I have a strong suspicion that most European voters have not heard of this guy, Nicolas Schmidt. Does that matter?
I'd like to think that it matters, but I don't think so. The problem with the Spitzenkandidaten system, first of all, is that it is not real. So, according to the treaties, the election of the European Commission president depends on two things. So first, the European Council, so the leaders of the different countries, have to nominate someone. And there is a line that says, taking into account the results of the elections. Now, what the political families did back in 2014, it was like, we want to influence that decision more directly, so we are going to propose candidates to be the president of the European Commission to kind of push them to the European Council so that they have to choose between these people. In 2014, it works. You had Jean-Claude Juncker, who was at the time prime minister in Luxembourg, and he was elected. But he was also a very European figure that everybody liked and respect.
I do kind of miss him a bit.
Sometimes, yeah.
Because he was good comedy.
I will never again attend a meeting of this kind.
Problematic, but fun.
Problematic fave, Jean-Claude Juncker.
And so then in 2019, political families did the same thing, but this time it didn't quite work. And then all of a sudden we had, I don't know where, the name of Ursula von der Leyen, and she was proposed to be the president of the European Commission.
Why was it her in the end? Can you just remind us?
It seems that Emmanuel Macron was who proposed Ursula von der Leyen because he didn't want to have Manfred Weber, who was the then candidate of the European People's Party. So he basically put a name that it was member of the European People's Party, so the party that had won the election. It was very close to Angela Merkel, so Merkel couldn't say no. But it was someone who didn't have as much power and as much presence as Juncker used to have. Because, as you said, Juncker was quite a figure. He had his own opinion. He was pushing for a very European perspective in his policies. And so that was very uncomfortable for leaders who like to control what happens in Brussels. So he came out with the name of Ursula von der Leyen.
I feel so honored and I'm overwhelmed. And I thank you for the trust you placed in me.
Funny thing is that on the one hand, you have Ursula von der Leyen, who knows she depends on European leaders, and therefore she has been always coming with the common minimum denominator in the policies that she proposed, because she always tried to propose something that she knows leaders are going to agree, countries are going to agree. And so she hasn't been as ambitious as Juncker used to be. And therefore, we often see that the policies that are proposed by the Commission then end up being even more watered down than they could have been if we would have had something more powerful, right? But then at the same time, she became also a political figure, especially on foreign affairs. She has been very active, and that has made some leaders a little bit uncomfortable.
The representatives of the Ukrainian people will have their place in this very hemicycle. Long live Europe. Slava Ukraina.
Now, that being said, going back to the question of does this matter or not, in my experience, it doesn't really matter, because even when we see these people in the different debates that have been taking place before the elections, most of them are not only not known, but are not even in European politics. Some of them are MEPs, but some of them are coming out of nowhere. Nobody really knows them. And it doesn't really matter, because in the end, it's going to be the leaders who are going to decide who they are going to propose. I think the only person among those candidates that really stand a chance is von der Leyen.
So von der Leyen's the only one who's got a chance, you think, from that group, but it's not guaranteed that she'll end up being president again.
No, because that's part of this game that we were talking about. So first, she has to be nominated by the German government, and she's making them a little bit uncomfortable with the way that she's talking about potentially joining forces with the far right to get the election. Now, it's unlikely that they wouldn't nominate her because they don't have a viable alternative. And why would you give up on the presidency of the Commission for your country? Doesn't make any sense, right? But then she has to be nominated by the European Council. And there she's going to have to get the support of the European leaders. And as we saw last time, you might think you have their support, but then someone might have come with a funny alternative. And then you also need the support of the European Parliament, because the part that I left out is that the European Council nominates the president of the European Commission, but then the parliament has to approve it as well. And there you need to have a large enough majority that is going to back your candidacy. And what we saw with von der Leyen last time is that even though the parliament was very upset because they ignored their candidates to be the president of the Commission, they ended up backing her with a very short majority, but they ended up backing her. So let's see how this play out. I think it's going to depend a lot on the results of the election, on whether someone can come up with a name that is a good alternative for everybody, and what is the weight that the different political families really have in this negotiation.
One of the things that seems to be adding more uncertainty is the fact that there's quite a lot of flux in terms of how different European far-right parties are going to group themselves together, right?
Yes. So this is very interesting, because there are currently two groups for the far-right in the European Parliament. You have the Conservatives and Reformers group, and then you have the Identity and Democracy group. And the Conservatives and Reformers were actually created by the Tories when they decided to leave the European People's Party back in the day. So I'm sorry, guys, but yet again, something that we can blame on the British.
Thanks.
There you have the Lay and Justice Party that was in government in Poland. You have Vox in Spain, who is in government with the European People's Party in a number of regions. You have the Sweden Democrats, who are part of the government as well in Sweden. You have Giorgia Meloni, who is in power in Italy. So you have a number of political parties that somehow have either been in government or are in government, and so are more institutionalized far right. This is what some people are starting to call the good far right, as if none of the racist and sexist comment that they make constantly was bad enough. But anyway.
The good far right. Wow. Yes.
And then you have the Identity of Democracy group. And there you have Marine Le Pen, who has not been in power yet. You have Lega with Salvini as a representative. You have, or you had, and that's one of the latest moves, AfD from Germany, that now has been kicked out of the group because...
The final straw, you ask? Well, that was Maximilian Krah, the AfD's lead candidate, who's under investigation for allegedly accepting bribes from China and Russia. He also controversially stated that people in Nazi SS uniforms aren't necessarily criminals, a comment that outraged Le Pen.
In any case, you have now a game in which you have Le Pen trying to convince Giorgia Meloni that they should join forces because she sees that she is considered as a collaborative far-right leader who has not opposed aid to Ukraine, who is pro-Atlantis, right? So she's considered as one of those good far-rights.
She has, however, been taking lesbian mothers off birth certificates.
Exactly. So. And when von der Leyen was asked about this, she was asked directly if that for her was a red line. She was saying, well, I wouldn't have done things that way. But so for some politicians, things like LGBTQ rights are definitely not a priority when they have to form these alliances. That's why, as we were saying before, it does have an impact on people's lives, the results of the European elections, because we're going to see less rights awarded to those minorities and probably a backlash against some of those policies that we have seen in the past. But then it is difficult for these political groups to work together because the thing about the far right in Europe is that it's very diverse and they have completely different visions about the way things work. You have some countries that have ties to Russia. Another interesting case is Orban trying to join forces with Giorgia Meloni, but having a significant difference in their approach to migration because Meloni, you have a frontline country when it comes to migration and what you're asking for is support. Whereas for Orban, the issue is we have to stop these people moving from one country to another. So for him, the approach is completely different, right? So all these differences between the way that they are approaching politics is making up until now almost impossible for them to be part of one single political group. But if they would manage to join forces and if the polls are right, they can easily become the second group in the parliament.
Right, I think that's quite enough depressing far-right chat for now. Should we move on? Something that felt like a really dominant theme a few years ago, just after the last European elections, was fixing the climate crisis. And we had all of these big policies announced, the European Green Deal. It really felt like Europe was trying to be a world leader in terms of having these really ambitious climate policies. And then this year, we've seen farmers protesting and some of the most ambitious EU green policies watered down in response.
Unfortunately, Madame von der Leyen, what we have seen is that you are lowering and really watering down the Green Deal for our farmers, as if green policies are the problem. The real problem of our farmers is they don't have a decent income. The profits go to the agro industry, they go to the supermarkets, they determine the prices and not the farmers. If you really want to help the farmers, you need to do something about our market model where the farmers are paying the price. And instead of that, you are pretending to help them by just removing some green policies. That is scapegoating green policies over the back of the real concerns that the farmers have.
If we see a more right-wing parliament dominated by right-wing parties that have been really trying to present themselves as being the best aligned with farmers' interests, even if that isn't necessarily the case, is it likely that we're going to see an EU that is less ambitious when it comes to green policy than previously?
Honestly, what we hear is that regardless of the outcome of the election, unless suddenly the Greens make a huge win and they become a lot more powerful, we are going to see a significant decrease of green policies in the EU in any case. That's partly because what we hear is that the perspective from a large enough majority is that most of what needed to get done has been done. And now it's not so much a moment to continue with the legislation, but it's a moment of making sure that the one that has been approved so far is implemented correctly. And also, if we think a little bit longer term, we are going to have to negotiate in the future a new budget for the EU. And I think if we have a majority in parliament that doesn't consider anymore that environmental protection, fighting climate change is a priority, a lot of that money might go somewhere else.
I know there's also been some fear about election interference during this election from states who might want to influence the results, like, for example, Russia. Is there any evidence that this is happening? And if so, what does it look like?
So one of the evidence is indeed this investigation going into how Russia and China were trying to influence some of those politicians that were running for the European elections. And then the European Parliament has been quite active in saying that this is already happening, that there has been significant attacks in a number of countries. It has been an ongoing issue, especially since the invasion of Ukraine. You have seen that there are a lot of voices that are trying to influence in the way that people perceive the action of the EU in Ukraine. It's true that I have talked to a lot of people who are questioning whether we should be helping Ukraine in this sense, because they feel that a lot of the money that could be invested somewhere else is being invested in Ukraine. And they're even repeating some of the slogans that we see coming out of Russia. So I think it has had an impact, especially in the countries that are closer and they're more exposed to the consequences of the conflict, but also in those countries that, because they are not exposed to the consequences of the conflict, because they don't perceive the threat as something direct to them, they might be more open to accept these different narratives. How that's going to translate into concrete voting, I think it's very hard to tell, and we might never know to what extent it has actually had an impact.
When you take a step back from the kind of nitty-gritty, dirty politics of all of this, it is quite awesome to think about how many people are going to vote over the next few days. This is the second biggest election in the world. But there are also a lot of votes that need counting. How does that work in practice? I know that there are people voting on different days. Do all the results come out at the same time? When are we going to have an idea of who's actually won this thing?
So actually, the election night is quite fun. All the journalists, we're in Brussels in the hemicycle where usually the MEP sits, and we get to hear the results right there. The hemicycle becomes a stage, and then you have all the results and out at the same time because people are voting from the 6th to the 9th. Otherwise, that could have an influence, right, on your own voting if you know already what's happening in other countries. By 10 p.m., 12 a.m. on Sunday the 9th, we might already know what the next parliament is going to look like. So it's quite fast. And then all the machinery starts, and then we'll see all those negotiations of the different political families trying to make groups, and all the candidates throwing their hats and saying, hey, I am the one who got the most votes, so I should become the next president of the European Commission. And all those different negotiations are going to start from the 10th. So that's going to be fun.
That bit at the end, it sounds like, you know, the end of Eurovision when all the votes start changing really quickly. It's already exciting.
Yes.
Funny you bring up Eurovision, because I think Petra, who presented Eurovision for Sweden this year, is going to be the surprise European Commission president.
I take my job very, very seriously. Hello, random Eurovision fan.
Oh, love that idea.
She did such a good job, and I really...
need good communicators anyway. So.
Right.
If there's one takeaway from this podcast, Petra for president.
Imagine.
Now, before you go, we've all got that person in our lives that says, oh, I don't really do politics, I don't follow it. And that's, I think, more true than ever when it comes to European politics. There will be many people that are completely unaware that these elections are even taking place over the next few days. As someone who has been living and breathing these elections, what would you say to that person in your life to convince them that their vote is important, that they should go out and use it?
I'd say that everything is really politics. We should have a say in what happens in our lives, and one way of doing that is voting. Most of what happens in our countries, in our regions, in our cities, is defined by European legislation. And by choosing who represents us in that parliament, we can influence what those legislations look like. And we should be voting for those who we feel are more like us and represent us more. So I'd say that we have a chance every 5 years to make sure that the parliament looks like we are.
This special episode of The Europeans was made possible thanks to the financial support of the Culture of Solidarity Fund, powered by the European Cultural Foundation, in collaboration with Allianz Foundation and the Evans Foundation.
The European Cultural Foundation are also one of the groups behind a great campaign called Culture Deal EU, which is trying to make sure that we don't forget to place culture at the heart of the political vision of Europe over the next 5 years. Culture often gets overlooked when it comes to elections, but they argue that culture and cultural heritage matter now more than ever. So check out what they're doing at culturaldeal.eu.
We also couldn't have made this podcast without the generosity of the listeners who keep this podcast going by supporting us on Patreon. You can keep Europe in your ears every week by sending a few bucks our way at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Thank you so much to our latest supporters, Jackie and David, and to Sonatan Graf for increasing their donations.
The show this week was produced by my co-host, Katie Lee. Thank you, Katie.
You're welcome. And thank you for being here with me, Dominic.
Oh, I wouldn't have been anywhere else. Thank you also to Wojciech Oleksiak, who sound designed and mixed this podcast, and to Katz Laszlo for editorial support.
We're away next week because Wojciech and I are heading to Norway for a journalism conference.
Ooh, fancy.
Very exciting. We'll be back the week after, trying to get our heads around what the hell just happened in these elections. We'll see you then.
Go and vote.